those who don't know me, my name is Diletta Lauro. I'm a PhD student at the Refugee Study Center, and my research is around the moral and political controversies around the state practice of deportation. And I look at the evolution of civil society movements and campaigns against deportations and removals in the United Kingdom. So I am very happy to have this great panel on approaches to campaigning, because I believe that the topic of approaching to campaigning is really a crucial link between moving from fortress Europe to sanctuary Europe. And as Councillor Rob Price was saying on the first day at the opening plenary, we need to build a counter-narrative to too often xenophobic and toxic debate around immigration and asylum in our European societies. So this panel aims to bring together different speakers who draw on their own experiences on campaigning and offer the perspectives on different approaches to campaigning. And I think this is very important to learn from successful campaigning, but also to reflect more deeply on the sorts of values and narratives that should inform our campaigning, to be self-critical about the ways in which we campaign, posing the question of who should be campaigning on behalf of whom, and thinking creatively about how different types of campaign can interact with each other and complement one another to build a more inclusive society for migrants and asylum seekers. So I just want to briefly introduce the speakers in the order in which they will be speaking. So we will start with John Flynn, who's the director of the Migrants' Rights Network and is a pioneer and expert on campaigning for migrants' rights since the 70s, really. Then we will move to Lisa Matthews, who's one of the coordinators of Right to Remain, a human rights UK-based organisation that does a fantastic job providing information on the asylum system, connecting together different grassroots and community groups. And then we will move to the perspective of Dr. Ellen Hinchins, I hope I'm correctly, who's a senior lecturer in development studies and social justice at the Erasmus University of Rotterdam. And she will share her time slot with Anila Noor, who's a refugee and a researcher at the University of Rotterdam. And then we'll close with hearing from Aderon Kapata, who's a courageous human rights and LGBTI activist seeking asylum in the UK, founder of Manchester Migrant Solidarity, a migrant-led community group in solidarity with migrants in Manchester. And unfortunately, Malkal Haddad, who's an Iraqi human rights campaigner, could not make it today because she's unwell and she sends her apologies. I don't want to take any more time. We're going to try to be for 10 minutes each speaker, each contribution, and then we can take a round of questions from the audience. And I'm very much looking forward to the discussion. So, John, if you want to come over.
Right, well, thank you, Diletta, and thank you for the opportunity to come and speak at this conference today. I appreciate that I'm the old guy on the panel, who goes all the way back to the 1970s to talk about these things. And I think if I've got anything to offer this, it's rather how not to campaign rather than campaign, because I can assure you my mistakes are vastly more numerous than the things I've managed to get right over the years. But we learn from learning from mistakes is as important as learning from, in fact, even more important than learning from successes. So here we go with my take on the issue. And I think I won't go all the way back to the 1970s, a bit more recent than that, but talk about the situation that we found ourselves in round about the turn of the millennium, when it was clear that the immigration debate, the whole terrain of immigration policy, immigration law in the UK was rapidly changing. And this was very much connected with the fact that immigration itself, we were once again back in that stage of what Stephen Castles and all his collaborators in their in the standard textbook called The Age of Migration. We were back there. People were on the move again. And they had been since the 1990s, and they were doing this in all sorts of categories and capacities, as workers, as refugees, as family members, as people wanting to use services that were being provided, international students being the obvious example of that. But once again, migration was happening. And the other thing that really had to be learned, for those of us who had been working during earlier periods, we'd come used to thinking that the business of migration, that the issue that had to be tackled, was essentially legal in nature. It was about a complex set of rules and regulations and procedures. There were plenty of opportunities for people to make mistakes, and what was essentially needed was a lawyer for every occasion, in order to guide people through all the mistakes that were there. And at one point, I mean, truly going back to my background, we'd had the beginnings of the infrastructure for that in the form of community-based law centres, some 60 or 70 of them across the country. We had very good citizens' advice bureaus, many of which had trained immigration advisors on their staff. And of course, we had lawyers. We had genuine lawyers, people working in law firms who were able to make use of the legal aid system in order to provide that advice. But what was actually being asked by these migrants had begun to change over the years. It was no longer about people who were stuck outside the country or people who were stuck at the borders of the country, down that he'd been detained at Heathrow Airport, or people trying to get visas for members of their family. The new migration that we were encountering was people who'd managed to find their way here. They actually crossed the border. They'd been able to cite a right as the basis for being able to cross that border, even if it was only a provisional one, like the right to have your asylum application properly considered, but only the other side of it being the right freedom of movements, the right to exercise free movement rights. And this is what was happening right the way from the first half of the noughties. The evidence was that migrants were coming into the country without the assistance of lawyers, establishing themselves in communities, again, extensively dispersed right the way across the country, and they were negotiating their own patterns and procedures and routes into settlement in one shape or the other. Often it involved law. Often it did involve finding people who could give them good advice about things. But in other areas, it involves social action of one sort or another, community activity. All of these things were happening. The picture painted that fast, it all sounds very rosy. But there were difficulties with it. One of it was that it was endlessly repeated. It was right the way across the country as being a completely unique phenomenon. So it's quite possible, as I found out, travelling around in the middle of the decade and interviewing people, finding out the way that immigration was impacting, to be able to go to two towns in Lincolnshire that were separated by perhaps 10 or 15 miles and discovering an advice and support group that had been established in each of those towns, and both of them being completely unaware of each other's existence. It was the wheel was being reinvented time and time again, right the way across the country. Very little push towards networking, sharing experiences, finding out what works, coming up with methodologies for what works. That was one of the things that had to be found out. I think one of the other things was that this pattern of the emergence of the new immigrant communities. It was often reproducing aspects of the immigration control system itself. It was refugees on one side, people whose form of migration was supposed to be fundamentally characterised by the fact that they were refugees in need of humanitarian protection, as opposed to people who'd come into the country exercising rights as workers or as family members. And this set off what often looked like a competition between different groups, each identifying problem areas for their own group, like worker exploitation for young EU migrants coming in into the country versus destitution amongst refugees. And the competition for the limited resources that were needed in order to provide remedies for these situations was often counterproductive. It often looked like a almost a Dutch auction, that our the group of clients that we are working for are more deserving than the this other group and ought to have a higher place in the queue. And this this produced consequences, I think. One of the consequences was that it failed to acknowledge the interconnections that often existed within migrant communities. The fact that a group of refugees and a group of migrant workers had a whole array of issues that were in common, such as the difficulty in finding employment or discrimination in the field of employment, issues to do with the welfare of their families, children, access to healthcare, and so on, all of which suggested projects, activities, programmes of work that could be undertaken, which reinforced a dynamic, a learning process which would allow people who'd managed to advance, who'd managed to secure gains, to be able to transmit those onto other groups. It also, I think, and perhaps this is the even more significant part of it, is that it fell in with a narrative that was coming through government increasingly from the second half of the decade, which is that immigration could be managed on the principle that there are good migrants and there are bad migrants. And once we have come up with a formula for being able to identify the good migrants and the bad migrants, then we can make concessions to them. If we are lobbied sufficiently hard enough on the part of one people who need our help and assistance as a priority, then we can offer those services or those benefits, but at the cost of the other group. The price that has to be paid for better consideration of asylum applications is carte blanche to act against people who've been designated illegal immigrants, who were deserving of sympathy from no one and who should be hunted down and excluded. And this has been an issue which I think we've had to deal with continually over the years, and it keeps reproducing itself in different forms. The way in which that's happening at the moment is being able to account for the presence of people who are characterised as economic migrants within the refugee boats that are crossing the Mediterranean at the moment. The fact that governments come to us when they feel that they have been obliged to offer concession, like allowing 20,000 refugees into the country over a five-year period, but on the strict understanding that there is a quid pro quo for that, and a price will be paid by another group of migrants. Now, I think, I'm probably having to come to the conclusion of what I want to say here, but that probably is the strongest indication of the challenge that is in front of us at the moment. And it relates to what Diletta mentioned at the beginning about the need for a narrative, which in my view, the fundamental obligation of this narrative is to explain why we once again live in a new age of migration. Why it is that we have managed that 30 years of neoliberal globalisation has once again created a world that is on the move, sometimes as refugees, sometimes as economic migrants, sometimes as mixed flows, people who've started, crossed their first border in order to escape persecution, but after 20 years in a wretched refugee camp, have decided that they deserve better than this, and they're looking for an opportunity where they can apply their skills and move on from this. And this does mean, the importance of this is a very interesting thing that's being circulating once again. It deserves to be circulated, written by Joe Cox's widowed husband, Brendan Cox, which was presented to the World Economic Forum just before Christmas, in which he sets out his reasons for believing why, despite everything, despite the fact that there has been really solid demonstrations of sympathy and solidarity with migrants all the way across Europe, we are still losing the argument. And part of the reason for that is that the argument that has its roots in a national perspective, that the state has a right to defend its borders and to advance its interests against other states and other populations in the world, still has more makes better sense to people than any argument that we have been able to put forward in its place. And that is the failing. We will continue to lose the argument. We will make progress because our humanitarian case is a strong one, and it will always attract compassion from large sections of the population. And during good periods, those sections will be large enough to get 100,000 people marching on the streets of the country and signing petitions and extracting concessions from government. But the fundamental proposition on the part of neoliberal globalisation, that states retain their authority to control, to impose, to direct, and to deprive people, working people who are fighting for better opportunities to survive, to deprive them of the most useful thing that would help them to survive, which is freedom of movement. So that's my appeal, I think, at conferences of this sort. I think it really is a challenge that we have to face up to in the course of the next couple of years if we are going to really build on. And there's a lot to build on. My criticisms, I'm sure, will be taken here as criticisms that are from one of you, a person who's been fighting these battles alongside you all of this time. But in order to be able to build on the real gains that have been achieved, it means coming up with better politics. It means answering the questions which people out there are asking of us. Why is there all this immigration in the world at the moment? And what do we need to do in order to ensure that it's better managed, better run, it doesn't produce so many victims? So that is the challenge in front of us. It has to be read into all of our campaigning activity in the future. Hopefully, if we can do that, we'll be able to report progress. Thank you.
Crikey, why not act to follow? So I'm going to be talking about community solidarity as a form of campaigning, and thinking about the way in which community campaigning can address some of the very issues actually Don was bringing up. And my organisation now is called Right to Remain, but we used to be called the National Coalition of Anti-Deportation Campaigns, which... not such a catchy name, but did describe what we were doing. And the reason I'm going to talk a little bit about that is because I think the evolution of our organisation reflects an evolution in campaigning. And apologies to the letter, who's talked to me at length about this many times for her research. So, and also I want to reflect a little bit about how government measures have quite successfully undermined community campaigning, but how we might now be at a turning point for that. So the National Coalition was set up in 1995, but for many years before that, there had been very strong community-based campaigns to try and stop the deportation, or in today's legal language, mostly a forced removal, of an individual or a family or a particular community from the UK. But at a time when the UK's legal system and political context was really quite different from what it is today. And these campaigns, these anti-deportation campaigns, as the name suggests, were generated by and focused on the end of a process, the end of the legal process. So people were often living in the UK for a very long time, often without the formal right to stay, but were able to get on with their lives and, to some extent, work, study, have families, and be part of the community in a way that you just don't see today. It's impossible today, and I think there's interesting comparisons to be made to perhaps the United States today, as opposed to the United Kingdom, where there's still a very high risk of deportation, but there's a level of kind of life that can be lived that I'm not sure can be in the UK, because the net of immigration enforcement in the UK has been drawn so tight. There's borders everywhere, and it's something that Don has spoken about and written about very well in lots of places, about the border not being at the geographical, just at the geographical border of the UK, but about being everywhere, in our homes, in our schools, immigration raids, landlord checks, bank clerks acting as border guards, academics acting as border guards, very little legal right to work without immigration status, the brand new criminal offence of driving without leave to remain in the UK, almost impossible to access healthcare, education and housing. So I would argue that social and legal exclusion is probably far more extreme today than it was back in the 80s and 90s and the beginning of the last decade, when anti-deportation campaigns were at their peak. And so in the past, it made sense to begin to campaign at that end point, when someone was told they were going to be deported from the UK. And these were very strong, usually very strong community-based campaigns, because people had been living in the community and had very strong links and had been living there for a while. And I would say perhaps communities were more political at that point as well. There were very strong links between these campaigns and anti-racism campaigns, strong migrant communities, and I think there's been a depoliticisation of some of that over the last 20 years. And a person or a family who was threatening with deportation, the community would come out and support them. But the campaigns often also around challenging the rules that were threatening them. So they were often very political campaigns, challenging a law or a policy that were negatively affecting lots of people. And since then, the legal and political landscape has been transformed, and generally not for the better. And that's why our work has changed as well. Because campaigns that start, that focus on the end of that process, for most people, just don't work. Many people aren't given chance to have connections with the community. The massive increase in immigration detention is one of the policies that's contributed to that. People are kept hidden away, locked away from their communities. For many people, the legal process, at least the part that is where the refusals and the attempt to remove people happen, is very, very quick. It's been sped up. So an asylum system actually, for some people, took a long, long time, can now be an extremely fast experience for some people. For others, they'll be waiting in limbo a long time. And campaigns that focus on calling for the intervention of the Home Secretary generally don't work anymore, because if the Home Secretary intervenes in a case, it's generally not a good thing. So public campaigns for individuals have, in most cases, ceased to have the impact they used to have. And if it's involving asylum seekers, there's an additional risk there about what does going public about your story mean for those individuals. So I think there's still a very strong case for people who want to go public if they have a human rights argument to stay, maybe on medical grounds, or family life community basis in the UK. But for many people who are fleeing persecution, going public brings them no extra guarantee of securing legal status, while can put them at great risk. So we've done a lot of work over the years trying to inform people about these risks. And I think we're also finding ourselves in what one of our allies has called the post-compassion environment. So that if you go public, you might get loads of people signing a petition, you might even get lots of people coming out on the street on a demonstration with you, but there's so limited, or if any, use of compassion or discretion in immigration and asylum cases that it can mean the person can be removed or deported anyway. So a lot of our work now is about how to help people at the beginning of the process, the legal process, informing people about their rights through our toolkit and through our training sessions, helping people to establish community links, and trying to get across this idea that inclusion and integration, as problematic as these words can be, should extend before someone's given immigration status or refugee status, because so often it's talked about when someone has immigration status. But someone who is in a strong position to fight for their legal case is often someone who's been integrated into a local community group or activist group already. And thinking about the action that takes place behind the scenes, not the kind of public individual campaigns, strengthening people's legal cases, and people giving legal information about how the system works and taking action for legal support, which is different from giving legal advice, at a time when legal advice has been so devastated that many people are entirely without a lawyer. And people who do have lawyers often don't understand the system enough because it's become so complicated to know if that lawyer's doing the right thing or doing anything on their case. And one of the issues we saw happen over maybe the last 10 years or so in the evolution of campaigns for individuals was perhaps less political campaigning for individuals' rights to stay. So that you could see public campaigns where the right to stay would be based on that person being a good human being, or because they volunteered in the community, or have never claimed benefits. And this kind of language is extremely problematic, and we have seen deployed in public campaigns, and we've worked quite hard to challenge this, because it begs the question, you're asking for this person to be saved, but at the expense of which other type of person? And we've also seen some worrying reinforcement of the idea of deserving citizenship, which Bridget Anderson and others have written quite a lot about. And as activists, do we really want to reinforce the idea that citizenship should be granted if it's earned because of certain values or certain behaviours? Most of the people we work with don't want to reinforce that, and yet somehow this language has been kind of co-opted in that way. And it's difficult, because if you're trying to fight for the rights of somebody to be given refugee status, immigration status, you do have to engage with the legal system that's there, with the rules that's there, and the political context that leads to those rules. But what we need more of is challenging those very rules, because supporting people to establish their rights within the legal system is essential, because it's so hard to even establish your rights within the system that's there. But if we just do that, we're going to be going backwards, because the rules are getting harder and harder to meet, more and more people are being excluded from protection, and so we have to challenge those rules so that we are actually defending the rights of more people. So to think about how community campaigning can address some of those issues that I've just mentioned. So one of the things we do at Right to Remain is talk about migration as being normal, actually. It's always happened and it always will happen. And that not just migration is normal, but community solidarity, community action for community members is also normal. And communities are doing this everywhere. They're protecting, they're defending, they're supporting their members. And a sense of local identity can be very useful when talking about taking action for someone's right to stay, most often behind the scenes rather than the public campaigns that I've just talked about becoming quite problematic. But this sense of local identity is also really important if you're campaigning for systemic change to the asylum and immigration process. And we've seen this with a lot of the work we're doing at the moment is around immigration detention and working with communities to try and challenge detention. Local communities saying no to detention because people from those communities are being taken from the community to somewhere far away and remote in prison-like conditions. And whilst we've heard already today about the brilliant campaigning going on with huge protests that have really kind of mobilised mass support at detention centres, we're also looking about campaigning happening around where people are taken from, not just where they're taken to. Because local campaigning actually can be quite subversive, because this idea of local identity, to some extent, can undermine this idea of the good versus bad migrant. Because it's about a sense of local belonging rather than being deserving. And it's about people's relationships with others. It's a human approach that allows for people's complex personalities and people's complex behaviour. Because you don't have to be a wonderful human being to belong. Communities can protect their members and negotiate this fact that people have a right to belong, a right to be where they need to be, even if they're not a saint, even if they're not a nice person. Because, and even if they've never volunteered anywhere in their lives, communities can defend people from being taken from them, and at the same time can say, more kind of broadly, we say no to you taking our people away, we say no to immigration detention, and we'd love to see more of that happening. Now, this local-based identity, which I think can be mobilised really positively, obviously still is slightly problematic. Who decides who belongs? For example, and that's a question that does need to be explored. But I do think that it starts to get us somewhere that allows for the complexity of human life. It's about the rights of individuals. It's about our relationships with others, and it's about coexistence. And when you have policies from the government that are meant to divide communities, like detention, like the hostile environment, community solidarity is resistance to that. It's a really positive, practical thing, and the solidarity part of that's really important. So it's not saying people deserve charity, It's not encouraging victimhood or vulnerability. It's about standing shoulder to shoulder with people, taking action together. And we can see a kind of resurgence of this people-to-people solidarity with what's happening with Calais, Dunkirk, and the Mediterranean. But I think the challenge is to make sure that solidarity doesn't exclude as many people as it includes. So this isn't just a movement for refugees or for Syrian refugees. And it's about people who are human beings and who have lots of reasons to migrate, because life is complicated and people are complicated. And I think really the bottom line can be, let's reclaim the idea of wanting a better life, because really, who doesn't want that?
Ellen and Anila. Your PowerPoint.
Okay, hi folks. I don't really know how to follow that. We're all complicated. I'm going to try and make this simple. We're going to talk today about advocacy, not because we're experts necessarily in advocacy, because it's something we're researching. In a typical academic fashion, we have classified advocacy. And academics always have to classify. So I was speaking earlier to someone and told them that we put their organisation under peer advocacy. But in a discussion, it turned out that wasn't quite right. It was more like community or citizen advocacy. So, you know, we make mistakes. But we're going to talk about only two of these today. First is the professional advocacy at the top. And the second one we're going to talk about is the fourth one, self-advocacy. But what is very important to say at the outset is that these are not discrete categories, they are separate categories. These are very much overlapping things that should be happening all at the same time, and hopefully without conflicts between them, because they're not choices. So I think a lot of the time when we're faced with choices, either work on deportation or work on, I don't consider those choices. In 2003, if you were an EU advocate against detention, this would be your landscape. By 2013, if you were an EU advocate working on detention, this is your landscape. It extends way beyond Europe, into the Sahel, into eastern, southwestern Asia, into Turkey, etc. So it becomes a much more global thing. I'm going to talk about a case of campaigning on detention by a group called the Global Detention Project. Before I talk about the Global Detention Project, which I think has a good name, I just want to mention something that seems to crop up again and again, particularly in the world work of a few activists within the Institute for Race Relations in London, people like Liz Piketa, who've written a lot about deportation, who've written a lot about criminalising solidarity. And she points constantly and consistently to this particular directive of the EU. It's got a lovely name. I'd like to read it out to you. The Directive and Framework Decision on Strengthening the Penal Framework to Prevent the Facilitation of Unauthorised Entry, Transit and Residence. If you can get your head around that, a lot of what we're seeing today is a direct or indirect consequence of this and other similar directives. So we could work, for instance, at the EU level to try and maybe modify these directives a little, because until we do, national governments are encouraged to put in place measures to implement this directive. So it's unfortunately, it's not even at the level of the UK or France or Belgium or Holland that we need to work, but this directive is telling governments to get tighter, tighter, stricter, stricter, and eventually there's proposals to criminalise help. So even the humanitarian sector has found itself affected by this. Let's not talk about rights even, but just help can be criminalised. Okay, so the Global Detention Project. These are all the things that the Global Detention Project has found across Europe and beyond, and they're only re-echoing things that we've heard here yesterday and today. So legal problems, problems of getting legal aid to people in detention, failure to provide translation. It's not something we've talked about very much, but I'm sure we'll all come across it. Once you get a lawyer, are the legal proceedings fair? They know the law
in court.
Failure to prove the case for detention. Detention is very often being assumed as the normal policy, rather than actually fulfilling the criteria that it has to be last resort. And then finally, the question of habeas corpus, which the Dutch have resolved by putting courts inside their detention centres. Sorry, I just found that funny. So the Global Detention Project is a really interesting one, because it's fair to say that their main concern is data. And one of the things that's very significant about the sector of working with detained, deported, and undocumented people is the spectacular lack of data. And if you don't have data, you can't influence policy. And if you can't influence policy, you can't do advocacy. Therefore, the Global Detention Project is simply asking for data. And I want to finish on that note.
I want to show you a table of the data that they were able to get and not get. So bear with me as I scroll to page 30. Do you want to scroll to page 30? Okay, is this it? Let's see. I haven't got my glasses on. Sorry, folks. Thank you, Poppy. Oh, yes, that's the one. You took my plastic glasses. Now, this table, you can't see it anyway. I don't know why I bothered to scroll. But let me just explain what you're seeing. You're seeing responses to requests for information from governments. So what the Global Detention Project was involved in was asking all these governments to give them information on all these categories. And I'll just read out some examples for you so that just to cut a long story short. Shall I? Okay. Austria, very good. Information received, information received, information received, information received, information not held. Not bad. Czech Republic. Refusal to accept. Refusal to accept. Refusal to accept. Information received, information received. UK. Information received, 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 not held. Okay, France, invalid answer. Information received, invalid answer. Invalid answer, invalid answer. Germany, big surprise. No information held in any category. But I think the reason for Germany may be that the federal system's not holding the information, but the states are holding information. So possibly it may have been a mistake in requesting information from the central government, but in Germany, no information is available at all. So I'm finishing now. Just on this slide, just exit from here. Okay, so poor old Global Detention Project. Yeah, they until they get that data, and they depend on governments for that data, but when it's not held, there's a fundamental problem of not wanting to know the information. Particularly, governments don't want to know how many minors they're holding. Those of you involved in child advocacy will be familiar with this problem. They also don't want to know, very often, quite how many people are detained in immigration detention. They also don't necessarily want to know how many of those people may be due for deportation or actually, and so on and so forth. So all subclassifications, different countries will have not available. I think there's only a couple of columns where the total information is available across the cases that they discovered here. So in this cycle, which is the advocacy cycle, which runs from problems, solutions, politics, to bureaucracy, blah, 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 comes from an article by Barbara Klugman on social justice advocacy. It's a general model, it's not specific to the refugee sector. But you need data at each of these points if you're a professional organisation. So working with on issues of undocumented, working
on issues of deportation and working on issues of detention, one of the problems is that nobody really in the government has an interest in knowing all the details. And so advocates have to kind of either get shadow figures from organisations like Amnesty or We the Refugees or whatever, but they don't have a handle on official data. So you may think it's very boring talking about data. I'm not a statistician. But I can see that if I was an advocate, I'd want the data. So we also need to get governments to collect data. I'm going to hand over to Anila to talk about something a bit more interesting.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you. Okay, now we have arenas of advocacy. And you can see there's agenda setting, access of decision making, so many complicated names. And if you are having lunch, maybe sleeping, because these are so complicated. So being a refugee, I think when these kind of things I listen, I said, oh my God, I'm not a professional. How I can do? I need some expert, some skilled expert for my advocacy. I can't do, but it's not right. So this is what I need. I need myself to educate myself. As yesterday and today, we heard again and again, we know our stories, and there's no one else who can say our stories, who can share our stories. Where this demand that when you are telling you are doing advocacy for us, please involve us. Few days ago, few weeks ago, there were few events who are doing advocacy or some seminar on refugees, but they invited me as a research, not as a refugee. So include us. And advocacy, for self-advocacy, I'm borrowing this term from that people who are with disabilities. They are using this term, this theme, and now I want to include this thing for self-advocacy for the refugees. Because if we can give them the confidence, the skill, they stand up and they can give the people to share their stories, they can do what they want. If you see what they want, they're feeling so helpless. They feel there is no one who can listen to them. So what they do, they burn themselves, they commit suicide. Because they want to speak out, they want to reach out, that people listen to them. So that's they do, but we want by self-advocacy, if we give them confidence, we give them the skill, they can speak, we can give them the platform, that they can come, they can share their stories, they will be, create a positive impression, and they can take the message. They are people like you who are ready there to listen their story, and they are, want to help themselves. So this is my personal request, because I remember 2 years ago when I went to reception center at Netherlands. After a few months, they said, you are ineligible to take the asylum in the Netherlands. And I feel like suddenly, why? What happened? It's my right. It's my right that I take the asylum. Why you are saying I'm not eligible to do so? So this is my right to claim asylum, and this is my right to do the advocacy for myself and for the others. It's not humanity, it's not charity only. This is my right to do so. So what we are doing is our right. And this, again, as I said, we adopt this whole self-advocacy for the disabled people they are using, but I want to give these skills to the refugees, so they can come with a confidence and they can speak for themselves. Yes, and this is our last slide. And I think people, what we are doing within the refugees, we need support and we need network and we need to openness within ourselves if we want to achieve our rights. Thank you so much.
I just want to speak to you about what I do, which is a bit of self-advocacy and also advocating on behalf of other people who are like me, because I believe that if you are advocating on behalf of somebody, the person that is involved should be at the center where it is possible, except where they do not want to be part of it. But oftentimes, I think people would like to be part of it. And people might not want to be out there for so many reasons. But it is still very, very essential that we let the campaign or advocacy revolve around the people who are experiencing the issues. What I mean by that is, I might just take you a little bit down their memory lane for some people that know me and the ones that do not know me. When I was locked up in Yass Road in 2012, for 1 year I was there doing nothing. Just waking up and, you know, enjoying the magistrate, I mean, Her Majesty's estate. Yeah, I had fun there. It was lovely. Why I said I had fun is I learned so much being locked up. I was saying the truth. Maybe if I wasn't locked up, I would not be doing what I'm doing today. So in a way, yes. But there are so many sad stories today that touches my heart still today. And I really cannot recover from them. I put that aside. Being there gave me so much to think about. People being deported in ways that they should not be deported at all. And that brought about organizing rights inside there. That's self-advocacy that we did. And we started campaigning rights inside Yass Road to shut down Yass Road. And that's where this shut down Yass Road and shut down all the detention centers came from. And for all of you that have been part of the campaign to shut down all the detention centers, I say thank you for advancing this campaign. It's gone beyond what I think it would ever be. I remember one day I spoke to Lisa, I think I sent you an email, and I said I was going to physically stop a flight going to Nigeria. They called it charter flight. She wanted me a little bit. And I know why she did. Because of the dangers involved. I was locked up, so I was incapacitated. There would be nobody to come to my rescue. But look at it today. When anybody has been deported or they're stressed persons in deportation, everybody stands up, rallies around them to help them. Some have worked and some have not worked. So we're not going to blame people for not meeting those ones that did not work for. It's not because they didn't do what they needed to do, but it went that way. So we just have to take it as part of the ones that we did not win. But I'm sure that a campaign to shut down detention centers, we are going to win it. Like I said, 2012. But if you look at the last 1 year, it's gone so big that it's caught the attention of the parliament. So much so that they even made us to come and give testimonies of what we were experiencing in there. That's part of campaigning. And that's led to so many people, even NGOs, interested bodies, medical staff and organizations coming to talk about the impact of detention center on people. It's not just the monetary aspect, which they always say the taxpayers first. Yeah, it does encroach into that. But what about the pains that we go through, that our friends go through? If I'm detained today and you know about it, the fact that you're even thinking about me could affect your life. What about that? How do you complement that? How do you pay for that? So what I'm saying in effect is there are so many ways that one can campaign. And when I started doing that, that's given me the courage to be able to stand up and campaign for other people in my position. For instance, what I've done, which is an approach to campaigning, is to ensure that I try to influence change in policy. even as much as I'm still an asylum seeker, but that does not define me because I wasn't born as an asylum seeker. I was born as a human being. Thank you for that. And I have developed myself just like any other person. So that's why I say we should not let our situation define us. Let us define ourselves as we are, who we are. If we are able to do that, there will be more that we can do collectively. And in fact, the strain on people that are advocating on our behalf will even be reduced. But I can understand why some of us cannot stand up and advocate, even on their own behalf, not to talk about somebody else's behalf, because of the fear of authority. So if you see people saying, I don't want my face to be shown, please respect it. They know why they're doing that. So it's not everybody that can stand up and challenge the government. For those that have done that, I would say I'm one of them. I am still reaping the consequence of that. But I know that one day it will come to an end. And I'll be able to say, yes, I've done something right. But it's not everybody that can withstand that. It is very, very hard to do. And what I've done is, for the LGBT asylum seekers, for those that are working with asylum seekers who are LGBT, would know that there's been a lot of change in the way that they now assess the application. There was a time that they would ask some very, very intimate questions. And I happened to be one of them that exposed that. And the Secretary of State then announced to have a review of the system. It's not like it's perfect. It's not perfect yet. But at least they no more accept, you know, explicit video of people or some other things that you might find insulting or personal. That's gone off now. But in the past it was there, some people would sit down in their offices and start watching pornography of LGBT people claiming asylum. So that is why it is very, very important. When the people who are affected are able to speak up, please do encourage them to do, but do not force them to do it. Let them know why it is important. Give them the information so that they can make an informed decision and see if that's what they want to do. If they don't want to do it, that's fine. As much as you are able to do on their behalf, continue to do it. And we will get a result. Definitely. It might take a while, but we'll get the result. Now they are advocating for 28 days for detention center. If you ask me, I will be shut down. Or if it's 28 days that we get, yes, let's see. If it doesn't work, then we'll start again and asking for it to get shut down. So if we push and push and push, we might be able to get to where we're going to. The same thing applies to the LGBT asylum seekers. There was a report that was just published, which I did put in some submissions on the stance of the UK on the right of asylum LGBT people globally when their rights are being breached. And I happened to write on behalf of LGBT asylum seekers, and I wrote on behalf of my country, because my country criminalizes homosexuality. And I use that as an example or representative of the 53 countries in the Commonwealth, where we have 40 that criminalize homosexuality. So these are the things that we should encourage ourselves. If we can do, please do let us do, so that we can begin to influence policy change and decision making. Thank you, sir.
All the speakers for their great and very insightful contributions, which I think recognize the strength and inspiration of different approaches to campaigns, but also to understand the limitation of various approaches and to be aware of what we're doing when we're campaigning. So I want to open the discussion to the floor and see if people have questions, and we can then take turns and reply to them. I think from what I understood, there are some questions about the legal language used around claims and asylum, but I think perhaps when we also talk about advocacy, we use language and vocabulary not in a legal sense necessarily, but I don't know if you want to add something on that. And then there is, I think, a more general questions about how can we make our campaigns and our struggles more collective and unite beyond that across borders and between different groups. So maybe if Anila, you want to start and then...
Yeah, I just want to answer his question. Mm-hmm. My claim and my right. I'm not going to UN books. I'm not going to dictionary. I know I'm a human being and I have a right. That's why I'm saying we shouldn't think only people who are having degrees or professional skill, only they are advocates. I'm saying we, being a neglected refugees, we can advocate for ourselves. This is my claim. Yes. Thank you.
And Don, if you want to say something perhaps about the more collective nature.
Sure. I mean, I think probably the first thing to say is that, I mean, we shouldn't talk ourselves down. I actually think there has been tremendous progress in recent times towards better coordination. It's often on an ad hoc basis, and it's facilitated through the social media rather than conferences or get-togethers. And the simple problem with that is that get-togethers once a year, and I would love to see us spend 3 or 4 days, everybody from across the country closeted together, who are working with migrant communities, migrant refugee communities, in order to give an account of what we've achieved during the course of the previous 12 months and what we're hoping to achieve in the next 12 months. The problem with that is the cost of it. Mm. It is extraordinarily difficult at the moment in order to be able to raise the funds in order to have these events. Mm. But nevertheless, it does seem to me that a fair degree of coordination is arising, mainly through the social media, because there are a number of key websites and blogs and so on, which is generating a narrative which is a reference point for most of us at some point or another to look at. So, you know, so when we're doing our advocacy, we know that's where the bottom lines are, the common issues, the agenda that we have to address, they're grouped around that. The perennial problem that we're always going to have is that migrants are such a diverse group of people and representing so many different interests and having so many different experiences. I suppose that's why I come back to the issue that really has to be accomplished, and that is the issue of the narrative, something that actually anchors all these different perspectives and viewpoints and experiences in a thoroughgoing account of why we now live in a world in which people cross borders at the rate that they do, and the different circumstances and the different categories that people cross borders. Mm. I actually think we're slow in stumbling towards that at the moment. Largely, I think, because there is a neglect of, frankly, the political economy of migration. Mm. The fact that it has been driven and affected so much by neoliberal globalisation. Mm. These are facts about migration which are only poorly reflected into our analysis at the moment. And there's actually a very good book by John Smith called Imperialism in the 21st Century, which is beginning to do this, and I'd recommend people to have a look at it. But if we can distill from that something that looks more of an account of why we made the world that we have made and why the movement of people is an absolute inevitable consequence of that. And once we've done that, that would be the point in which I think we really do stand the best chances of turning the debate around.
Thank you. And Lisa, I don't know, Lisa or the Rankers, if you want to add something.
Yeah, I think we have recognised the fact that there is no much coordination amongst the NGOs and all of the organizations that are working around migrants and refugees. not because they don't want to coordinate, but because the system probably does not allow that to happen. One, you've just mentioned about 3-4 days in a year to want to meet, but that's not possible because of finance. So we can see how it's been made impossible.
Precisely, yeah.
But at the same time, with what we've got, we can still do something. Mm. And that's why Manchester Migrant Solidarity, which is one of my groups which I started to, just for us to support each other, we met with Right to Remain. This is an organization, and two other organizations, Simon, and another one in Newcastle, Beyond Borders. And this was what we saw too, and we thought, how can we do this? So we've come together, and then we formed a network, which is called Migrant Solidarity Network. It's only just started, we've only just had our first meeting, and that's in the north of England. But we are looking at rolling it across the whole of UK, so it's like a test case for us. We want to see how people can come together, regardless, even if you are not an organization, if you are an individual who feels so passionate about what we're doing, we want you to be part of us. So please and please, I don't know if you don't mind, we might not have your contact, but if you have them with the conference organizers and you would want us to have access to that so that we can send you information around that, then you can see how we can collectively do this. Because, you know, numbers, we know numbers work. Numbers do work. And you guys are doing good job. Let me tell you one thing. I cannot do this on my own. I cannot fight for myself alone. I also do need you. And if you're ready to fight and I'm not there, or cases like me are not there, you cannot fight. So as much as you want to do it, we want you to do it with us. And we would want to work with you. So please and please, if you like that, we would collect your information from the organizers, and then we'll roll this up for you.
Yeah, thank you.
Just to add to that, I don't know if that's absolutely right, and Don's mentioned it as well, to point out the kind of structural problems. It's not a kind of lack of will or an accident that groups aren't managing to work together as effectively as we'd like. It is it's a consequence of the divisive asylum immigration system, and that's where this solidarity network came from, that it's for groups who both support their members, their individual members who are going through the asylum immigration system, but it's also wanting to challenge the system. Because what we've found is that, especially because of lack of funding, most of the groups we're talking about are unfunded grassroots voluntary groups, and they've often got no funding at all. They're dealing with members having crises, a member being detained, and a member facing deportation, and a member being refused. And those daily crises really affect the capacity of a group to organise. And that's not an accident, that's deliberate. These kind of day-to-day emergencies are there to try and stop people being strong and being part of, you know, a movement to challenge these things. So this is a small part of the many things that are going on, including the really important stuff Movement for Justice are doing, to try and challenge this whole scale, bringing people together.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you're also talking a bit more practically, because we hope that this conference is an opportunity to take action after talking about it. But if we have some other questions,
Can I first respond?
I
just wanted to respond to our friend, the cleric, because I think it's really important to bring up idealistic things for all of us to cheer ourselves up. And I think one of our rights is to say that states are the problem, that state boundaries are the problem, that nationalism is the problem. And we shouldn't really be too ashamed, because I think the problem is if we confine ourselves to the realistic national context, we end up saying, but we must help the far right not to get stronger because they're scary. Yes, they are. But if we limit ourselves to national solutions only, we'll never come up with idealistic solutions which could address the roots of the problem. As I think Don has pointed out, neoliberal globalization is truly global, and we can only tackle it with some vision of the global. So whilst I'm not in favour of the Ottoman Empire returning or the British Empire in order to make us global, I think we have to stick to that idealism, that there is some kind of international solidarity also, we, of course, I'm not asking for too much, I hope, but that we're all citizens of the world, and we would like to see it also at that level.
Excellent.
Thank you.
May I have an input?
I would like to hear also from other people, and then perhaps... there was, the first question was about mobilizing people in a climate of hostility towards immigration and migrants and asylum seekers. And then there was another question about, well, I think Mariana's testimony also made us think about what do we do for people who fall between the cracks of the law and the legal avenues available. And then there was, I think, this last question about influencing the public and thinking about the questions of justice and how the state is both perhaps not adhering to its own laws, but also how it's important to fundamentally challenge some of these legal categories. I don't know, perhaps, Lisa, you might have some thoughts on this.
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts. I'm trying to think about mobilising people, and obviously we've got really great examples of that happening anyway right now with the kind of solidarity stuff we're talking about with Calais and Dunkirk and the Mediterranean. And that's just been a simple thing initially of people saying this is the government's position is not what we stand for. We will not stand for this. And this goes back to what I was saying about the idea of local communities saying not in our name, that we do not want this happening to our people. We do not want this happening to people. But you have to be able to make that kind of human connection for that to happen. And I don't think it can always be planned, because the kind of real groundswell of refugees' welcome movement came very suddenly when there's been people in Calais and Dunkirk for a very long time. There have been asylum seekers facing problems in the UK for a very long time, and we've all been working very hard to raise awareness of this, and it takes one moment sometimes to catch people's imagination. So I think sometimes it's also about being able to respond quickly. And I think that's something that people volunteering in Calais and Dunkirk are doing really well, and it's something that Caroline was kind of referencing. This very much like a can-do attitude. Obviously it can create problems, because people think, right, I want to do something, I want to set up a new centre, and that's a brilliant sentiment, but obviously there are already lots of established organisations. But I think we need to capture that incredible energy and spirit of we can fix this, we can make a difference ourselves, that kind of autonomous grassroots spirit. And actually some of the work Right to Remain has been trying to do is to try and link up a lot of new volunteers who have got engaged with Calais, Dunkirk, Mediterranean with established groups that already exist. So we just had a couple of events in Sheffield where we had people who are new to this issue who were sending aid out to Calais, for example, but wanted to know what they could do in the UK. And we invited along the more established South Yorkshire groups. But I think it presents a real challenge, actually, to the established sector. That we can say all we like, actually there's already a group doing this, but the speed in which volunteers are acting is so fast, we need to be more responsive, and social media is absolutely the key of that. The amount of communication and networking we're doing on Facebook, which actually wasn't that useful for campaigning until a couple of years ago, is now suddenly becoming so useful. So I think we've got to be, again, self-critical, thinking, well, I know we've been doing this for 20 years, but do we necessarily have all the answers? And be light on our feet and be willing to reach out to people. I think there's been a kind of almost a defensive attitude from some people, which is understandable, to say, but we've been doing this for 20 years, we know what we're doing. But we always need new people, we always need new blood. So I think it's combining those two that's going to be crucial.
Thank you. I don't know if anyone wants to also answer some of
these
questions.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick response. I think it was to Caroline's point about the appeal for new stuff. And I'd just like to temper that a bit, because it seems to me that we it's not so much new ideas that we need at the moment, but it is a capacity for learning about all the ideas and projects that people are working on at the moment. The whole idea of networking is actually not principally about innovation. The idea of networking flourishes because the phenomena that we're dealing with, which is that an oppressive system, is complex. It operates at so many levels. It operates at the level of the economy, the way law and order is enforced. It operates at the level of culture, what's in our heads, the way that, that we relate to each other. And when you've got something as complex as that, there is no one gee whiz, you know, big bang idea that is going to suddenly push all of that backwards and open up a new way for us. What there is, though, is hundreds, possibly thousands of projects that take on this oppressive phenomena. They break it down into bite-sized chunks. They learn how to push back, to defeat it, to erode it, to split it open along the lines of its tensions and its contradictions. But the most important thing is a network allows people to learn what works. From those hundreds and thousands of projects, ideas are shared backwards and forwards, and we recognise what the learning curve is and how we can work with it in order to build resilience, because we're not going to win any big battles in the near future. The stars are set against us on that score. What we ought to be aiming to do is to build resilience into the sort of movements that Anaranke and other people are building up, so that they are still around in 5 years' time, probably in 10 years' time, and 15 years' time, when the opportunity for really winning the big battles might just be on the cards. So that's my appeal at the moment. I think if people aren't familiar with Migrants' Rights Network, I mean, please do have a look at our website, because that is the experience that we really try to capture, to review what is already being done there at the moment, to try and examine that, to try and identify what the learning curve is in all of these activities, and then see what value we can add to that process, rather than coming up with a big new idea.
Thank you. I don't know if you have any other comments, Ellen,
I would like to. I would like to respond to the appeal for help, please. I would like to suggest something very practical, because I think there's no point being interested in general solutions if we don't have some response to direct appeals in front of our nose. So I also don't see the difference between advocacy, necessarily a rights-based approach, and a humanitarian approach. They can be quite seamless in practice, despite academic distinctions. So I would suggest that perhaps we use the mailing list of this conference, so that people who wish to write some kind of letter of support, and possibly if you have a lawyer, I'm sorry, I still don't know your name, but if you have a lawyer, we can use, you know, you can contact me. I'm giving my permission. Anyone else who doesn't want to give their permission, you know, you can let the organisers know. But I would welcome a letter that tells me what you want to hear, that I've found you to be an upstanding and wonderful citizen. That if this can make any difference whatsoever to somebody's case, then we can all write letters here. If that doesn't make any difference, maybe we can just think with you about possible avenues. But certainly, I mean, I think I certainly have heard what you've said, and your appeal was pretty direct and unambiguous. Thank you very much.
I don't know if you, Adronke or Anila, have anything.
Yeah, I was going to probably talk about how to respond to, Maria.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very, very happy for your response.
Mm-hmm.
So many other people must have been doing that in their respective organizations or in their respective capacities. But maybe if we collectively, today, respond and help her, because I could feel what she was trying to explain, and I'm sure it did touch a few of us, if not all of us. She might not be able to put into context everything that she was feeling. I need help too, but I think you touched me most today, and I'm sure people here are ready to help you, and I have to say thank you for offering that help. And I hope that it goes well for you.
Mm.
Thank you. Well, on that note, if we don't have any more comments, I suggest that we continue speaking after the session. Thank you very much, everyone.